Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, today there are a wide range of pocket-sized devices that put the information resources of the Internet at our fingertips. But in the process, it seems, they have created a problem for the justice system. Now, jurors, when they're hearing a case, they're told by judges that they should only consider what happens in the courtroom, the evidence and the testimony presented, and that they should avoid coverage of the media, not read the newspaper, not discuss the case. But apparently, we have some evidence that across the country, there are jurors who are disregarding the instructions of judges and, in fact, doing their own research, in some cases even posting updates on cases that they're considering on social networking sites. All of this clearly violating the instructions given them by judges. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about juror behavior generally, about the rules of evidence, and about this particular problem. And our guest for the show is Olin Guy Wellborn. He's professor of law at the University of Texas, has been there at Texas since the mid-1970s. He's the co-author of a number of books that are used in law schools around the country, books that have to do with rules of evidence. And we're pleased that he could spend a little time with us talking about this subject. Questions are welcome. We ask only that people calling in with questions and comments are brief. We ask that so we can keep things moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, questions and comments from callers are welcome. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call. Professor Wellborn, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, good morning. It's a beautiful day in Austin. I hope so up there as well.
Well, it's a little cloudy, but we have some promise of some sun later, so we'll see how that develops.
Good.
Just as a way of starting, I guess we could talk about this particular instance that has been fairly, I think, widely reported. That's the thing that caught our eye about this trial. It was a federal drug trial. It was going on in Florida, where initially a judge found out that a juror was doing this. He was doing outside research using the Internet. And apparently the judge thought, well, if it's only one person, maybe we can live with that. And then when he actually dug a little bit deeper, he found out that eight other jurors on the same jury had been doing the same thing. Do you know any more about this than, you know, just what any of us could read by reading the New York Times?
No, I only know what the papers have reported. I got a call from a Times reporter, John Schwartz, who happens to be a graduate of our law school. And we discussed the problem, and I later read his article where he found a number of other instances of similar difficulties that had happened around the country. But it was the Florida case was particularly egregious, I think, and they declared a mistrial after, as I understand it, the several weeks of trial, which is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a catastrophe. In terms of the resources expended and I suppose arguably fairness to both sides to have to start over.
Well, and in fact, in that the piece in the New York Times that you mentioned, they quoted a defense attorney who apparently was told by, I'm not sure how this was communicated, but he got the idea from the jury that, in fact, he was close to winning. And
wow.
So after all of that effort to be told, well, no, we're just going to have to toss this out. And if we're going to do this, we're going to have to start all over again. I'm sure for everyone concerned, but particularly for him, that would have been a very discouraging outcome.
Yeah, that's a big disappointment. Of course, you never know what that, mm-hmm. you know, what information, whether his information would have panned out. But yeah, that's one of the problems of a mistrial that late in the game. And I think there's very little that can be done about it. I think the judge had to declare a mistrial, and the remedy is start over.
Yeah. One of the big questions, and I suppose it's a question that we really don't have a very good answer to, is how common, how widespread a problem is this? Is there any way of knowing that, you think?
John probably did as well as one could expect being a very experienced professional journalist to dig around, and he seemed to find that there was a widespread concern about this kind of jury behavior. I'm not surprised in a way. The world has changed so dramatically in the last 15 or 20 years in terms of people's behavior about information, if you mm-hmm. think about it. I was thinking about this the other day that if you go back, let's say, just 20 years, and a juror is given these general instructions about don't talk to anyone about the case, don't read about the case, don't watch any news programs about the case. As a juror, you would really only have to be attuned to that. Let's say you really want to comply with respect to if you get a newspaper at home, generally that'd be it, one newspaper, and the evening news on the television. If some other issue besides what's going on currently is the problem, and I want to go into that, mm-hmm. things like medical or scientific expert information. A typical person might have an encyclopedia at home, if they're lucky, and a good dictionary. But if they're going to court during the day and then at home in the evening, so they don't have a library, those kinds of sources of information, a single encyclopedia, dictionary, are fairly harmless if you think about it. But today, we're accustomed to feeding our curiosity sitting at home with vast sources of information, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So part of the issue is here that should people decide they want to do this, they now have a means to do it that they didn't have before. The access to information, a very wide range of information is there, and it's very easy. A lot of people do have access to the Internet, either at home or and apparently in this particular case, this was actually going on in the courthouse. People were using small portable devices that they could access the web with. So that access is there. At the same time,
and not just access, but habit. I'm trying to slow down a little on this multitasking, but I spend a lot of time watching. I watch a lot of nonfiction television, and there's a lot of great nonfiction television now, science, history, mm-hmm. military, and so forth, with my laptop sitting in front of me. And if something catches my interest on the television, I'll go on the web and read more about it while I'm watching the TV program. And it's just my way of life now. And so I think that there's a lot more temptations presented to a juror if they are curious, that they want more than they've been getting in court. The temptations are much greater now than in the past. I think there's an answer that is the rule. The rules in place with respect to what the jurors are supposed to do and not supposed to do are appropriate. That hasn't changed. I think what must have not happened in this Florida case is to communicate effectively to the jurors what the rules are mm-hmm. at the outset.
It's my understanding that judges actually, in addition to the more traditional kind of instructions about don't discuss this with your friends or family, don't read the newspaper, don't watch local television if they're hearing a case, I think that now judges are also adding to that instruction, yes, and stay away from the Internet. So mm-hmm. I guess the question is, though, do you think here that part of the issue is that the instructions that judges are giving to juries are inadequate or not strong?
Well, if nine jurors went off the program in a single case, something's wrong. that shouldn't happen. And obviously the judge was stunned to find that it happened. And I can imagine, you know, as a teacher of what are supposed to be grown-ups, just telling people something once isn't enough. You know, I think the judge needs to return to the question more than once and also be more concrete in giving examples of things they're not supposed to do. I think that helps, just in terms of, you know, it's like with a child. It's like you're dealing with a child, right, as a parent. You have to explain it to them in practical terms and give multiple examples, and then maybe the message will get across. But then they have to be reminded again, you know. So I think, for instance, I would, as a judge, tell the jury, look, you're going to be hearing testimony from expert witnesses, which is usually the case nowadays. And they may be talking about subjects that about a certain kind of specialized information, such as medicine or chemistry or whatever. You may not be satisfied with the information you're hearing from the witness and may be tempted, as you might do on your own in a situation, to go on the internet and look for more information. That's forbidden. You can't do that. And maybe give them a little explanation as to why they're not supposed to do that. That's tougher, but it you might get better compliance if you explain to the jury why they're restricted in that way. And that's a tough thing to do because it gets pretty abstract.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Olin Guy Wellborn. He's professor of law at the University of Texas, and we're talking a little bit about juries and jury behavior, and particularly the problem. We don't know the scope of the problem, but we know that it has been a problem of juries essentially disregarding the kind of instructions they get from judges about seeking out outside information, things outside of what happens in the courtroom, information having to do with the cases that they are hearing. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign and line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm sure you've seen the movie or the play, 12 Angry Men. Where there's a famous scene where the character played by Henry Fonda refutes one of the key points of the case by, which was a unique switchblade knife that was the murder weapon. And, well, Fonda went walking around the neighborhood where the young man who was accused lived in and bought an identical one and presented it and so on and so forth. Point being is that and having been a juror myself, too, I've been a little bit frustrated by the fact that the jurors are not allowed to ask questions, at least not during the trial, and only in limited ways and when they're in deliberation and so forth. But part of the problem, I think what you're getting at, maybe you ought to address this, and just for my own edification, because it sounds like it's desired that a juror walk in, take his seat, and completely divorce himself from his own life and experience and knowledge and so on and so forth. And just be a kind of an automaton that sucks in the data that's given in the particular way it's given to him and is expected to forget anything else that he knows to the contrary and take him there. I don't think I've framed a question very well there, but maybe you get at the gist of what I'm getting at is that you know, jurors, we who are jurors come in and we know about the world and know about other things, and we certainly know when we're hearing something from either the prosecution or the defense that we don't think is right, and perhaps we want to confirm that in some fashion. Could you address that, please? Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thanks. That's a very good question, and you actually framed it very well. I love the example. One of my favorite movies, one of the great movies, period, and certainly about law, 12 Angry Men, and that is a dramatic moment when he brings in and slams the knife point into the table. Because there had been this evidence. The claim was that the knife used in the killing, that was known to have been used in the killing or identified as used in the killing, was also, there was a knife, exactly the right type of switchblade in the possession of the defendant. So this was argued to be a strong evidence of identification of the defendant as the perpetrator. And the point Henry Fonda made was that actually that knife was pretty common, and he bought one in a short break during the trial. That's actually against the rules, what he did. And that's tough, isn't it, when we have this example of breaking the rules actually leading to a better outcome. I'm glad that you've had experience as a juror, and you mentioned that it's very frustrating, and it is frustrating in a lot of ways. We know that jurors find the experience frustrating. Did you feel like you were being treated like a child?
I think, well, the caller's rung off, but I have a from what he was saying, I guess I have a feeling that he would likely say yes.
Yeah, you know, they feel like they're treated like children.
Right.
They resent the whispering going on at the bench. You know, we're grown-ups. Why can't you treat us like grown-ups? And, you know, it's like being treated like a child where the grown-ups are whispering so that you won't hear. And yet you're given this responsibility. And you know that your things are being withheld. It's conspicuous things are being withheld. And it's very frustrating. One thing I'd like to say in response to the caller's comments, and I think he was on to this difference. He talked about you come in as a juror with life experience and things you've learned. You're not told to use that. It's all right. It is expected that jurors have a lot of experience and knowledge that they've learned in their lives. And that common fund of information is okay. Now, you're asked during jury selection whether you know anything peculiar to the parties or peculiar to the case. And in general, if you know too much, that's a ground that you won't be seated on the jury. So we have to distinguish between information that's peculiar to this case and these parties and so forth, which, again, the selection of process for jurors is nowadays designed to weed that out, all right? So you have jurors who don't know anything peculiar to the case. What they learn about this case is supposed to come through the evidence. But their knowledge is available to them, and they can use it and they can share it, whatever it's worth. That's not against the rules. The difference is what information that you set out to acquire after the trial has begun. So let's say, for instance, there's a medical issue in the case and there's expert testimony back and forth about a particular problem, and a juror has either personally had that problem or a family member or a co-worker's had that problem and he happens to know more about that problem than what was said, it's legitimate for that juror to share that information, I think, and the jury to consider it for what it's worth. But there's a big difference between that kind of information, which the juror, if you will, innocently comes in with, versus going out and doing your own investigation after the trial has started.
Well, I think this gets at the question of why it is that the system, the trial system, is set up the way that it is in this very controlled fashion where everyone knows who will testify. Everyone knows both sides, defense and prosecution. Everybody knows what the evidence is. Everybody knows who's going to testify. It's likely that everybody knows what the witnesses will say. You know, there's this old saying about if you're a lawyer, you should never ask a question you don't already know the answer to. There's not supposed to be any surprises as far as the attorneys in the case are concerned. That I suppose some people might not understand or might question the reason for having trials run in that manner.
You mean the restrictions on the jurors' other sources of information?
That and just the fact that it seems that both is in the interest of both attorneys that the case be presented in as, I suppose, as straightforward, as simple, and as clear as they can make it, making the kind of argument that they want to make, the one making the argument that the person is guilty and the other making the argument that the person is not guilty. You know, it seems like they're trying to keep it as clear and as simple as they possibly can, because obviously because each attorney has in mind the outcome that they want. One wants a conviction, one wants an acquittal.
Yeah, they aspire to control, but that aspiration is almost always frustrated to some extent. Mm-hmm. For one thing, because they have opposite agendas. And so, you know, however much you think you're going to control the presentation, there's someone just as smart as you are on the other side who wants to mess with your parade. But I think let's talk about the restriction on juror research, for instance. The history is useful here. The jury trial, as we know it, began as something almost opposite. We, of course, got the concept of the jury trial, which is not worldwide. It's limited to our legal tradition in the form we have it, which is the English legal tradition. And the English actually had it brought to them from Normandy with the Norman invasion, what was called the inquest, in which if there was a dispute, whether civil or criminal, in a village, people from the village would sit as the triers of fact. And that was not done in other legal cultures. And those people became what we call jurors. Now, but what changed dramatically is that the original idea was, if you want to know what happened here involving Jane and John and Mike, let's talk to the people who know them and who have sources of information about them, the people who live in the community and who know the reputations and the history of these people and can do their own investigation. And they did. The jurors were expected to not to rely on solely on the information at trial, but to be little detectives. But over the centuries, that system gradually step-by-step changed into something that's very much the opposite, where the jurors bring in the mores of the community and the common knowledge of the community, but they're supposed to get their information about this specific case not through their own resources and through reputation and so forth, but under controlled rules at the trial. Now, why did it change? I think one reason is the parties, their advocates, the lawyers and the parties of the world, I think understandably wanted more control over the sources of information, the case-specific information, not general knowledge, on which the decision was going to be made. And it comes down at the end of the day to fairness, and fairness as the adversary system has achieved fairness. One of the problems with a juror going out and looking up, for example, information, is that a lot of things out there are unreliable or can be misinterpreted. And if you are a party, let's say you're an accused, and some theory, some he said out there is going to be used to potentially to convict you, as a matter of basic fairness, we think that that shouldn't be done behind your back without you or your attorney having the opportunity at least to look at it and question it and challenge it and maybe present indications that that's not the case. Do you follow me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so when a juror goes outside the rules, I don't see it as a technical violation, but as something that really goes to the of our ideas of fairness in the adversary system, that we have these tools that we make available to both sides of oath and cross-examination and being able to argue against one interpretation or another of what a person says. We have all those rules that are in place for basic fairness. And when a juror does something like was done in this Florida case, they simply end run around all those rules. Hmm. And the juror may feel better, but the juror may be misled by what they find. And all of us are inclined to be too gullible to draw conclusions too quickly without listening to another side.
Well, let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in on a cell phone here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I missed the block towards the opening of the show, so please forgive me if this has already been addressed. But why not simply ban any handheld devices that, you know, can that could be used by a juror?
I think I appreciate the comment of the caller. I kind of think actually in some places that they're doing this, and I suppose that might help. But then you still don't you cannot control what people are doing when they're out of your sight and when they're at home in the evenings and when they're not in the courthouse.
I agree. I think it's probably routine to disallow telephones, you know, Blackberries, computers, all those things to the jurors while they're working at the courthouse, but it's when they go to their car or to their home that and there again, the only thing you can do is explain to them as clearly as possible that is a violation of their oath,
yeah,
and that they can be severely punished with contempt sanctions if they are caught violating their oath in that way. I really do think you need to read them the Riot Act and make clear that you can and you will be put in jail for a period of time if you break these rules.
Well,
I just don't see any other way to get people to behave.
Yeah, did the caller? Did
and
you
the threat of real sanction?
Yeah. Did the caller want to follow up?
No, that's fine. I thank you for your comments and answers.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Our guest this morning on Focus 580 is Olin Guy Wellborn. He's professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law. Has taught there since the mid-1970s. Is the co-author of a number of books that are used as text in law schools around the country. Books that have to do with rules of evidence, mostly, and other legal topics as well. We're talking this morning here about a little bit about juror behavior and about the fact that it seems that at least we have some cases that have now popped up in the media of jurors that are disregarding the instructions of judges not to do outside reading and outside research about the cases that they're hearing, that this is made all the easier by access to the internet that people have at home and some cases with pocket-sized devices that they apparently are even using in the courtroom. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I guess we've touched on this, but it seems that maybe not only is this a case of that where the judge needs to give a much stronger set of instructions and also tell people that there will be penalties if they don't follow those instructions, but maybe in a larger sense, there needs to be some education about how the jury system works, how trials work, and perhaps why it is that it really matters that people follow the instructions of the judge, and that they don't do that. They're supposed to only be thinking about when they go and they deliberate only what has been presented in court. Maybe people don't really understand why it is that's important.
I think that's right. I do think that's very daunting, though, to the things I was just talking about, the notions of procedural fairness about information. As I say, it's pretty abstract. It's pretty subtle. I think... As I say, it's abstract because I mean a lot of people in a given situation might say, yes, I understand how another person who's not as sophisticated, they wouldn't put it that way, right? But they might think this, not mm-hmm. as sophisticated as I am, might be duped by information they look at on their own, but I'm not like that. Mm-hmm. You see, it doesn't mm-hmm. apply to me. And being sold on these across-the-board rules, it's a tough sell, I think. It's a tough sell. I think we're talking about a pretty sophisticated education, and I wonder whether that, I mean, it's always a good idea. I don't know where that would come from.
Yeah.
And again, we have the problem that culturally we've got things like 12 Angry Men, which the astute caller, first astute caller, mentioned, mm-hmm. in which going to the outside information actually turns out to be beneficial in the particular mm-hmm. case.
Well, I'm sure that it's true that for people who have never served on a jury and never been involved in a legal case, if all they know about how trials run is what they've seen on television or seen in movies, it's going to give them a distorted impression of what happens in courtrooms.
Yes, I mean, that's true. Although a lot of those, the best of those literary movie examples and TV examples are actually pretty instructive. And pretty good. You know, that I hear that prosecutors complain about what they call the CSI effect,
mm-hmm.
in that there's a lot of us. I don't watch CSI because I don't watch fiction, but I watch tons of nonfiction law enforcement stuff on television, and it relates to my work, so I can claim that I'm working while I'm sitting there watching First 48 or Forensic Files. But what you hear the prosecutors complain about is that as a practical matter, all this forensic stuff isn't available in everyday cases, and juries are often nowadays disappointed, and if it's not a lot of forensics nailing down the guilt of the defendant, they wonder why not, mm-hmm. and they become suspicious. So these the media things do affect, we hear, unsurprisingly, what their jurors' expectations when they come in, which may be disappointed.
One of the things that I find myself wondering, and you noted earlier, certainly correctly, that now because of the Internet, people have access to so much information that they didn't before, and that in the past, if someone was going to disregard the instructions of the judge and try to go outside of the courtroom, maybe all they would have had to turn to was their local newspaper or perhaps local news reporting about the case that they might be involved in. So access to information is much greater.
Or, as I say, maybe an encyclopedia.
Yes.
I'm not sure what people were looking up in this Florida case, whether it was they were getting information about fact issues in the case about the individuals, or whether they were getting information of a more general, for example, as I say, there's expert evidence even in these drug cases,
mm-hmm.
Whether they were researching things like that. In a sense, it doesn't matter that much because of what I was saying, that mm-hmm. the opportunity to challenge what the jurors are considering is the really important thing to me in the rules of the system.
Yeah.
But in particular, again, as I say, thinking back before the Internet, you could look in an encyclopedia if you want to read about, I don't know, whatever technical thing has come up, but you're not going to find much. And it's not going to fit your case, but you can keep looking and looking and looking. As you know, if you're doing a web search wanting to learn some particular technical thing, you can learn a hell of a lot in a short time sitting on your computer at home, if you're motivated. And Lord knows that a lot of the jurors are going to be motivated to want to know more.
Well, it makes me wonder whether in the past, even in the pre-internet days, how many people were, to the extent that they could, were doing things like that, or were or at the very least, they were reading the paper. They were disregarding. How many people, even in the past, were disregarding judges' instructions, and we just didn't know about it?
I think that's that. Yeah, who knows? you know, the temptation to again, if you can think, well, this is against the rules, but it's really actually helping justice. If I learn more, why shouldn't I learn more?
Mm-hmm.
People can rationalize a lot of stuff. And I do think that's a problem. One of the things that hasn't come up yet is I think if we admonish the jurors more rigorously about what they're not supposed to do, do we also tell them that if they learn that another juror has done a no-no, that they're supposed to rat them out to
yeah.
the court? And I think they probably should be told that. You know, that's another deterrent, you see, because a juror might think, well, I want to know more about this, and I'm going to look it up. And then they might be influenced by something outside the evidence. But then the next step is, do they share it with the other jurors? And I guess in my view, it makes it worse if they do share things with the other jurors that they've learned outside the evidence. It's in terms of rocking the boat of the system, maybe admonitions might nip it in the bud in the sense that you might not be able to deter a juror from exploring her curiosity. But then when it comes to sharing it with others and using it as a basis to argue for a particular verdict, then she might hold her tongue because she knows that everybody's been told they're supposed to rat her out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if there's 11 other people in there, somebody's going to rat you out.
Well, it's my understanding with this particular the case we've been talking about, the Florida case, that is exactly what happened, that the jury was deliberating. One juror contacted the judge to say that another of the jurors had admitted that he had done this. And then the judge asked that juror about it and found out, yes, that was true. But then found out also that these other jurors had done the same thing. Nine of the jurors had apparently admitted that they had done this.
Yeah, that's right. And so, yeah, it started with someone tattletaling.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's very likely to happen, don't you think, that someone is going to rat out another juror, as long as they understand what the rules are, right? If they're told what the rules are, don't break these rules, and don't tolerate other jurors breaking the rules.
Well certainly, as I have read people talking about this problem, it seems that a lot of people feel the only real solution is that jurors will have to police each other. And I suppose that you put your finger on it there. We not only you have to make it clear to people what you want them to do or not do, and then you have to make it clear that if you see misconduct on the part of other jurors, that you, as a member of this jury, it's your responsibility to hold up your hand and say so.
Yes, and I think, you know, everybody can be like a West Point cadet for a short time, can't we? You know, it's the old cadet oath, you know, mm-hmm. A cadet will neither... what is it, lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate anyone who does, and that this code of conduct that says you're obligated to rat miscreants out to the authorities, and lawyers have that obligation of ratting out one another for breaking rules. All lawyers operate under those obligations all the time, and they frequently will do it. And I think ordinary people, if you think about that 12 Angry Men, it's such an excellent and has such a ring of truth to it, all the personalities in there. If one of those men had openly broken a rule, one of the others didn't like him is going to go to the judge. Or one who's just a stickler is going to go to the judge, first to the bailiff, and then to the judge and say, hey, wait a minute, this is wrong. So I don't think I'm being naive. I hope I'm not being naive to think that as long as you get these messages across, that you can nip in the bud these investigations. As I say, I'm less sanguine that we can stop people from going on the web when they go home at night if they're so inclined. I mean, that's them and their spirit. But then when it comes to the next step of sharing it and making it part of the basis of the group decision, that's probably deterrable.
Yeah. We have a couple of other callers. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Olin Wellborn. He's professor of law at University of Texas School of Law. And we're talking about jury behavior and whether or not they pay attention to the instructions that judges give them about restricting themselves only to the information that's presented in the court. We have a couple of callers here, and we'll go next to Urbana. And this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was a juror about 2 years ago here in Urbana, actually, in a county court. And the way it works here is you serve all week. I ended up serving on two cases that ended up in hung juries.
Wow.
If you could. And the problem was that neither the prosecuting attorney or the defending attorneys provided any conclusive evidence. You know, one was a he said, she said case, and one was a drug case. And there was evidence there, but they said there was, you know, saying, well, I couldn't have done that because I was doing this at that time, but nobody proved it. There's nobody who said, oh, yeah, he was with us. You know, it just seemed like, as the jury, which we very carefully followed the rules, you know, we in fact started out by discussing what the judge sent us away with and saying, okay, these are our parameters. But we had a million questions, and so we could never come to a conclusion because there wasn't anything that was conclusive. We wanted to ask questions.
Yeah, you know? That's another thing that's very frustrating. Is it's like being, can you imagine being a student through a college course and you're never allowed to ask anyone a question? Could you really learn if you're never allowed to ask anyone, you know, a teaching assistant or professor or a fellow student a question? And that's something that is hard to justify and explain. But there are courts that have allowed experimentation with questions by jurors. It has been done. Officially, the law in most jurisdictions is it's allowed in the discretion of the court with proper safeguards. But if you read the opinions about where they've allowed jurors to ask questions, the safeguards that end up being recommended are pretty burdensome. There are a lot of problems with allowing jurors to ask questions, and nobody's going to just allow a free-for-all of jurors asking questions. But I understand that. That's a related issue. But what happened in your cases was the right thing to happen. That is, it's hard to see how a mistrial is. That's kind of no answer. Why did the juries hang rather than come in with not guilty if there was a feeling that there just wasn't a definitive answer? Because some of the jurors thought that there was a definitive presentation.
Well, in one case, there was an alleged rape, but the people knew each other, and
those are always.
While everybody felt that something had happened to her, mm-hmm. some people didn't think that it had been proved that he had raped her. And this was the case where she said, he raped me at this date. And he said, well, I couldn't have because I wasn't there. I was driving to such and such. And we thought, well, okay, well, why didn't the defense bring somebody to say, oh, yeah, because he said I was with my family driving to Chicago. And why didn't a family,
there was no alibi
why wasn't a family member there? Or why wasn't there a gas station receipt or, you know, something like that? But everybody agreed that something had happened to her, but some people didn't think that. Maybe it was consensual, but now she regretted it. You know, we couldn't come to an agreement on that. And then in the other case, it had to do with possession of drugs, and some of us felt his explanation was just so ridiculous as to be not able to be true. And other people said, well, I know people that stupid who would do that.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how, you know, we just couldn't. We went around and around and around. And in fact, the second case, it was Friday afternoon while we were deliberating, and 5 o'clock rolled around, and they said, and we're like, okay, so what are you going to do with this? Oh, we're ordering dinner. You have to stay. And then they took all our names and numbers. They had to call everybody so our families knew where we were and everything. And, you know, the judge came and, you know, we sent something to the judge. He called us into the court, said, you can't come to decision. He says, okay, consider these rules again, and sent us back out. We went out for several more hours, and we came back with the same thing. And, you know, it was just not clear, and there wasn't enough evidence on either way to say, you know, it wasn't that either person was a bad person or whatever. It's just, you know, you couldn't come to a conclusion.
Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, that's a good outcome, right? I mean, that's the system work. The prosecution has the opportunity, if they think they can, if they can, in fact, put together a significantly better case, to take another crack at it with another jury. That usually doesn't happen with a hung jury, because there usually isn't a better case. You know, if there were, they would have had it the first time.
I want to thank the caller. I have a couple of people here and only a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to see if I can get at least one more caller in, and we'll do that. This is someone on a cell phone, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I was on jury duty, and I have kind of an example that I've thought about from my experience, having to do with outside research and knowledge that you have or knowledge that you gain right then. The breathalyzer or something had gone out of calibration supposedly a couple weeks before, but they only calibrated every 6 months, so probably it was still okay.
Yeah.
And
it had been calibrated 2 weeks before.
It had been calibrated 6 months and 2 weeks before. And so probably if it had been
weeks.
Calibrated.
So it was behind schedule. It was on a six-month schedule, and it was actually behind schedule.
Right. And so, but they had used it, and they had data from it. And so they were concerned in the jury interviewing portion that how people would take this, because they knew that the prosecution was going to try and use it, and the defense was going to say, well, it wasn't calibrated, so that doesn't count. And that they asked somebody who did kind of lab work a lot of questions about equipment and what did she know about equipment and did they calibrate it, da-da-da-da-da. Now, I do a technical thing for a living as well, and they didn't ask me anything. And I thought about that, and I thought that it was because I had really more of a background than this other person seemed to have, and that she was just kind of following the rules, and they were interested in her understanding and her conclusions, whereas I had the background, I had school backing me up, I would know sort of how a calibrator did, and they weren't worried about me. They were worried about her conclusions. And I thought that was interesting.
That is very interesting.
They felt
that you had more knowledge, but you had more than a little knowledge.
Yeah. And that I had lived with this knowledge, and I used equipment and had opinions about it, and so that seemed to me to be kind of an example similar to doing research. Now, you could look up things, but then you wouldn't have lived with it and worked with it and thought about it. And
that's a very good illustration. Because it goes back to the famous, I think, is it Pope? A little learning is a dangerous thing. I think it's Alexander Pope. That the attorneys on both sides were more concerned about the person who might have a little bit of knowledge and then be misled and mislead others than the person who actually had a good grounding.
You know, I need to jump in here. I want to thank the caller and apologize to one we can't take because we're just here at the end of the time. And I suppose I don't know whether this is one of those things that we've had some stories about it and it's gotten some attention and maybe then we'll go on to something else. Or do you think that it's likely that we might be hearing more about these kinds of cases, problems in trials because of this kind of juror behavior, and it's something that indeed will get to be more of a serious problem?
I think it will. I think we're just seeing the beginning of a wave that's going to be a long time cresting because of the prevalence of these smaller devices and more young people adept at accessing the internet in a variety of settings. That's what's still changing. And there's a big difference between the young and the old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't use handheld internet, but my children do all the time.
And so you're going to see the continuing increase in people who are, again, have habituated to seeking information that's available to them all the time. And that will increase these problems.
And do you think any of these other things, perhaps things that might further satisfy the curiosity of jurors, possibly presenting more evidence or allowing them to ask questions, do you think that the way that trials are conducted are likely to change in any substantial way?
No, I don't. I think because a lot of these frustrations of jurors and efforts to try to come up with other ways to make things more comfortable all around, those issues have been around for a long time, and there just aren't easy, good answers to those questions.
Mm.
You know, the complications are inherent, and that's an area where technology doesn't really change the difficult problems.
Well,
like letting jurors ask questions.
Yeah.
That's just a really difficult problem because the desires of the jurors to do that is very understandable, but the problems that are created for the parties and again, I'm not worried about the attorneys and the judges because they need to accommodate the real people in the picture. But the problems that are created are just not easily solved.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Olin Guy Wellborn. He's professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law. Professor Wellborn, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.